It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. Our top story continues to be the U.S. military strike against Syria. On President Donald Trump's order, U.S. destroyers launched missiles into Syria Thursday night in retaliation for a chemical weapons attack blamed on President Bashar al-Assad's forces that killed about 100 civilians. President Trump issued this statement at his presidential retreat in southern Florida, that is, following the strike.
There can be no dispute that Syria used banned chemical weapons, violated its obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention, and ignored the urging of the UN Security Council. Years of previous attempts at changing Assad's behavior have all failed, and failed very dramatically. As a result, the refugee crisis continues to deepen, and the region continues to destabilize, threatening the United States and its allies.
The dozens of Tomahawk cruise missiles targeted an airbase in western Syria in retaliation for the chemical weapons attack that American officials believe Syrian government aircraft launched with a nerve gas. Syrian state TV called the U.S. strike an act of aggression. Early Friday, Russia responded by saying its relations with Washington would likely deteriorate after the U.S. missile strikes. The deputy chairman of the Defense Committee said Moscow may terminate interaction with the U.S. military regarding Syria. Russia also said it would seek an urgent meeting of the U.N. Security Council to discuss the U.S. act of aggression in Syria. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The U.S. military strike against Syria, a key Russian ally, comes ahead of U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's visit to Russia within a week. Tillerson travels to Moscow after attending the G7 foreign ministers meeting in Italy next week. The strike against Syria is likely to be a top item on the agenda when Tillerson meets with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. The U.S. strike on Syria occurred as Trump hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping at his Florida presidential retreat. Trump said he had quickly developed a relationship with Mr. Xi, and he predicted they were going to have a very great relationship. President Xi did not make remarks or comments while reporters were in the Mar-a-Lago dining room. Earlier, President Trump and members of his administration made it clear they hoped to pressure Beijing into doing more to rein in North Korea's nuclear weapons development. Trump said the roughly $310 billion U.S. trade deficit with China is high on their agenda during the two-day summit. The United Nations Security Council has strongly condemned North Korea for its latest ballistic missile test this week. In a statement Thursday, the Council said it is concerned about Pyongyang's highly destabilizing behavior and flagrant and provocative defiance of the Security Council. Earlier Thursday, the European Union imposed new sanctions in retaliation for North Korea's repeated nuclear and ballistic missile tests, including its launch of a rocket into the Sea of Japan on Wednesday. Former U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton spoke at an international summit on women's issues in New York Thursday night.
I'm okay, I will put it this way. As a person, I'm okay. As an American, I'm pretty worried. So I think I'll take off my person hat and put on my citizen hat. And, you know, there's a lot to be concerned about.
Clinton says there needs to be an independent, nonpartisan investigation regarding allegations of Russian meddling in last year's presidential election. She lost to President Trump. The U.S. Senate is poised to confirm President Trump's Supreme Court pick after Republicans forced a historic change in the rules governing the chamber, ending the minority party's ability to block high court nominees. A vote on Judge Neil Gorsuch is expected on Friday. Republicans used their majority to alter Senate rules to defeat a Democratic procedural blockade of the nominee, known as a filibuster. And a minibus hit a landmine in southern Somalia Thursday, killing 20 people, injuring one other. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting from Thursday's parliamentary election is underway in the Gambia.
Results have already started trickling in. The United Democratic Party, which formed part of the coalition, is leading the majority of the seat. They are winning over 30 seats of this 53 National Assembly.
That's reporter Sini Marina in the Gambian capital, Banjul. Nigeria's Anti-Corruption Commission will appeal a court ruling that gives back $5.8 million to former First Lady Patience Jonathan. Uganda welcomes refugees from progressive policies, and South Africa's opposition Democratic Alliance Party calls for a nationwide protest today, Friday, to pressure President Jacob Zuma to step down.
South Africa faces a choice now and in the years ahead of the 2019 election. Either we can have a growing economy that creates jobs and that respects the constitution, or we can have an ANC government, but we cannot have both.
Jordan Lewis is a member of South Africa's parliament, and it appears South Sudan's national dialogue may not take place after all due to lack of funding. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vote counting from Thursday's parliamentary election is underway in the Gambia. These are the first elections since strongman Yahya Jammeh was forced to flee the country. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Sini Marina in Banjul.
Gambia went to polls to elect 53 member National Assembly that will steer the affairs of the Legislative House 5 years. As I speak now, I am at the Independent Electoral Commission headquarters in Kanifing, in the outskirts of Banjul. Results have already started trickling in. The United Democratic Party, which formed part of the coalition, is leading a majority of the seat. They are winning over 30 seats of this 53 National Assembly. And then the opposition Gambia Democratic Congress, which is now the biggest opposition, is also having at least 4 seats.
That's Vio Stringer, Sini Marina, speaking from the Gambian capital, Banjul. The chair of Nigeria's Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, the EFCC, says his agency will immediately appeal Thursday's court ruling ordering the commission to release $5.8 million to former First Lady Patience Jonathan. The court had frozen several accounts connected to the former First Lady as part of President Muhammadu Buhari's war on corruption. But in his ruling, Justice Mujisola accused the EFCC of abuse of process. The EFCC suffered another setback on Wednesday when a leading judge was clear of any corruption charges. EFCC Chairman Ibrahim Mustafa Mangu says the commission is appealing the ruling because of what it calls increasing judicial hostility towards President Buhari's war on corruption. He says the commission will not apologize to Mrs. Jonathan because she cannot explain the source of her wealth.
We are suddenly appealing against the ruling. We are going to do that as soon as possible because it merely shows the hostility of the judiciary in the fight against corruption. I mean, we are battling with the issue of corruption fighting back. I'm sure you've been monitoring, and this cannot be far from the truth. We do not agree with the judgment, and we are certainly going to appeal immediately.
Did you say the hostility of the judiciary in the fight against corruption?
Yes, exactly.
Are you suggesting that the judiciary is not 100% behind the fight against corruption?
Of course, definitely.
Any reason for saying that?
It's an issue of concern to us and concern to the fight against corruption in Nigeria.
This was just one part of the EFCC's challenge to the holdings of the former First Lady and some of her associates. There's still some money that you have challenged in court. Do you intend to pursue that?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. We are appealing against the ruling, and we will proceed to the logical conclusion.
The former First Lady has said that she would like a public apology, clearing her that she is not a subject of a criminal investigation. Would you be willing to give her an apology?
We are still on the matter. There is no question of apology because she cannot explain the source of the wealth. Apology should not come in here.
But she was former First Lady. Are you saying that she doesn't have any source of income?
Well, not known to us, not known to the law.
Some people say that President Muhammadu Buhari and your EFCC, you have engaged in a witch hunt of President Jonathan and people in his in the former government.
It's not true. That is not true. It's all right. We go after people when there is an issue. We don't invite people. We don't come into matter unless an offense has been committed. And we conduct a lot of background checks. Sometimes we carry out preliminary investigation for more than 6 months before we ever act on an issue. So we make sure that there is an offense committed before we come in. It really doesn't matter. Corruption has no color, no tribe, no ethnicity, no party affiliation.
Aside from the former First Lady, are you also investigating other former officials of the Jonathan government, including even the former president?
We are carrying out a lot of protracted investigation on a lot of issues. But what I'm telling you is that it has nothing to do with party affiliation or whatever government. What we are going after is financial crimes, wrongdoings that has to do with the looting of government funds.
When you mentioned some of the quote anti the fight against corruption, I'm assuming Nigeria has an independent judiciary. One would say that the fact that they made this ruling is an example of them doing their job.
I wouldn't know, but the apparent hostility has even increased these days. The hostility from the judiciary has gone beyond. I'm sure you have seen the judgment of the judge and his wife that were discharged yesterday. So it's really very funny if you have known the depth of the investigation that was carried out. Though that matter was not our case, it was not being prosecuted by my office.
Ibrahim Mustafa Mangu is the chairman of Nigeria's Economic and Financial Crimes Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. South Africa's opposition Democratic Alliance Party has called on citizens across the country to join a planned protest today, Friday, to pressure and battle President Jacob Zuma to step down. This after lawmakers from the Democratic Alliance petitioned the Speaker of Parliament seeking a vote of no confidence in President Zuma. But in a statement on Thursday, the ruling African National Congress, ANC, said it would strongly oppose any attempt to pass a vote of no confidence. Jordan Lewis, opposition lawmaker from the Democratic Alliance, tells viewers Peter Clotty that South Africans are displeased with President Zuma.
It's a Democratic Alliance motion of no confidence in the president. It's the sixth one that we have moved in 6 years. We've moved on every year since 2011. And we want to give ANC members of parliament the opportunity to do the right thing and to vote with their conscience and to fire Jacob Zuma.
Some are saying that this is yet another publicity stunt by the DA because the ANC is not going to move an inch following a decision by the top echelons of the party to allow President Jacob Zuma to stay in office. What do you say to that?
Well, if indeed ANC members of parliament vote to protect Jacob Zuma again, then it's important that that is on the record and that the country has the opportunity to see that. They know what Jacob Zuma has done to the ANC, to the country, to the economy, and they must have an opportunity to put their votes on the record and for the entire country to see them defend him.
What is the basis of this latest vote of no confidence that the DA is espousing?
Well, despite the fact that Standard & Poor's and other rating agencies warned South Africa that its credit rating was on a knife edge and that political instability and policy instability would result in a downgrade, Jacob Zuma went ahead and reshuffled his cabinet last week Thursday evening, resulting in an almost immediate downgrade from Standard & Poor's and certainly more to follow from other rating agencies. That has profoundly negative consequences for the economy and for ordinary South Africans, and that's more than enough reason to fire the president.
There are 400 MPs in parliament. The ANC has 249. Do you believe the DA will have what it takes to convince at least 50 members of the ANC to join in your effort to pass this vote of no confidence?
We are trying our very best to speak to every ANC member of parliament and convince them to do the right thing. But I must be honest with you, I expect them to do what they have always done, and that is to defend and protect Jacob Zuma, because they are not particularly interested in doing the right thing anymore. They are interested in saving themselves and making sure that they remain in power.
Are you in talks with the EFF?
Definitely, we are always, constantly.
What is the DA's message in Parliament to South Africans? Some are expressing concern about the direction of the country at the moment.
Well, our message to South Africans is simple. South Africa faces a choice now and in the years ahead of the 2019 election. Either we can have a growing economy that creates jobs and that respects the Constitution, or we can have an ANC government. But we cannot have both, and that is the simple choice that faces every South African ahead of 2019. Protesting is important, and we encourage everyone to join the protest tomorrow and in the coming months. I'm sure the protests will get bigger and more widespread. But as important as protest is, nothing is more important than the ballot. And in 2019, South Africans have to use the power of the ballot to change their government.
What are your thoughts about the cabinet members and deputy ministers who have resigned from parliament as well?
It gives them a wonderful opportunity now to speak out without any of the hindrance or encumbrance of office. So I hope that those who have resigned yesterday and today use this opportunity now to speak out and tell the truth about what happened in the Zuma government and what continues to happen.
John Lewis is a South African parliamentarian. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Pretoria. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 7th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. The national dialogue, which President Salva Kiir announced last year, has not materialized, even though the president said it was to begin in early March. A member of the National Dialogue's steering committee, appointed 3 months ago, says members have yet to be sworn in. A presidential spokesman says Juba does not have the money to organize the event. Tito Justin has the story from Juba.
The South Sudan National Dialogue President Salva Kiir initiated in December was supposed to start more than a month ago, but nothing has been scheduled. His steering committee member Joseph Okello says he and other committee members are waiting to hear from Mr. Kiir when they should begin their work.
We have always been hearing from the president and that the national dialogue arrangements are underway. Our names have been announced, but we have not been called by the president to be sworn in as members of the committee, and therefore I'm still waiting to hear when this will take place.
Earlier this year, government officials said the steering committee would come up with a budget and draft a plan to start the process. Presidential spokesman Atenyi Weka Atenyi says the government lacks the money to organize the dialogue.
The money has not yet been put in place by the Minister of Finance for the national dialogue. And the situation remains as I talked to you last time. There's nothing new on it.
President Kiir earlier nominated local think tank, the Sud Institute, as a focal point for the Secretariat of the Dialogue. Abraham Awolich, a senior police analyst at the Sud Institute, says time is running out and the national dialogue needs to start soon. He says the government should put in place a number of structures so that people across the political spectrum participate in the process. Awolich suggests the government consider how decisions are made at the dialogue so it can proceed peacefully.
And so when we launch, it is not the beginning of the dialogue, but then the beginning of the process of consolidating the dialogue and developing the agenda and identifying stakeholders and getting them to agree on the agenda itself. So it is going to be a laborious process. That is why we think that it should start so that we can take time to put all these things in place.
He says South Sudanese are eager to hear from the government about what's happening with the dialogue and wonder why it's taking so long after the president made his announcement.
The people of South Sudan are waiting. This is something that they think could rescue the country and end the crisis the country is undergoing right now.
Last month, South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makwe set preconditions for the armed opposition and people in opposition-held areas of the country to first renounce rebellion before being allowed to participate in the event. Church leaders, opposition politicians, and civil society activists criticized the preconditions, warning the dialogue would fail if the government continues to insist on such preconditions. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Somalia's new president declared war on al-Shabaab on Thursday, replacing the country's military leadership and giving the insurgents 60 days to surrender ahead of a fresh offensive. The announcement follows approval last week from the Trump administration for the Pentagon to step up U.S. airstrikes against al-Shabaab. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The Somali president, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, walked to address the media dressed in a military uniform. His message was clear. He said the government was tired of terror attacks carried out by militant group Al-Shabaab. Bomb attacks have become a common occurrence. Because of that, I would like to announce to the Somali people that the country is in a state of war, and the state of the war is not going to be on one front. This war will be a justified one. The announcement to carry out a whole-scale war against Al-Shabaab comes a day after the group detonated a vehicle full of explosives at the Interior Ministry building, killing 7 people and injuring dozens. Al-Shabaab no longer controls any major Somali towns or cities, but the group continues to stage bomb and gun attacks against government forces, workers and civilians. Abdullahi Halake, a security analyst on the Horn of Africa, says Somalia's government lacks the capacity to carry out a major offensive against Al-Shabaab.
The only problem is, does he have the capacity to take an all-out war to Al-Shabaab? Does he have the army? Does he have the police? Does he have special forces to do that? Well, you know, he has said that is what he wants to do, but capacity would be one thing completely different.
While campaigning for president, the Somali leader vowed to secure the country and build the army. The state depends on some 22,000 African Union troops to defend the government and the population against Al-Shabaab. Last week, US President Trump approved a request for additional precision airstrikes in Somalia to help the African Union and Somali ground troops increase pressure on Al-Shabaab and deny the terrorist havens from which to attack US citizens or interests in the region. Some security observers in the region say the president will depend on planned U.S. airstrikes and African Union troops to carry out the offensive. In an effort to defeat the Al-Qaeda-linked group, the president replaced security officers in the police and intelligence service. The Somali president called on citizens to support the operation. We would like the Somali people to work with the government soldiers who are ready to stabilize and bring peace to the city, so that people can lead a normal life. Children can go to school and people who visit our country to be safe without worry about their safety. The government has called on the youth fighting alongside Al-Shabaab to surrender within 2 months in exchange for training, education and employment opportunities. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
If you are a refugee in Africa, Uganda may be one of the better spots for relocation. Newcomers are allowed freedom of movement, and Ugandans, for the most part, are welcoming. From the refugee settlements of northern Uganda, viewers Jill Craig reports on the country's unique refugee policy and how it came about.
No one would choose to be a refugee, but many are forced to do just that. They flee violence at home, face restrictions in their new country, and are usually dependent on others for food, water, and health care. Uganda, a country hosting more than 1.1 million refugees and asylum seekers, is trying to ease their burdens with what many analysts call its progressive refugee policy. Senior settlement officer in the Ugandan Prime Minister's office, Solomon Osakan, works with the UN Humanitarian Agency to coordinate refugee operations. He says his country's approach comes from a pan-African mindset of helping Africans in trouble, which currently includes those in neighboring South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burundi.
So I think this policy emanates from our leaders. Previously, most of our leaders were displaced as refugees. They sought asylum in neighboring countries and went as far as Europe. In that time, this changed their perception and thinking that when you're a refugee, you need to be supported to survive, otherwise hostility only worsens.
Uganda has refugee settlements, not camps. Host communities have donated much of the land for these settlements. Refugees receive a 50 by 50 meter plot for shelter and cultivation, enjoy freedom of movement, receive employment waivers in order to work, and can start businesses.
It's good because in Uganda here, we are feeling good. There is no fighting like South Sudan and other things also, they are good.
Not everyone is pleased. Near the recently opened Mvepi settlement, some local people complain that so-called outsiders are getting the jobs, not them.
But the bad thing here is we are lacking of a job. Those who are here, they don't give the job for us.
The United Nations and Uganda's government say many of the jobs in the settlements require skills that are not always found in the local communities. Despite his grievances, Charles Achema says he is happy his country is hosting refugees.
As you have known, Uganda is a God-loving country. That's why they welcome refugees here. Yes.
Many refugees here complain of food shortages. The United Nations has cited underfunding as the problem. Last year, food rations were cut by 50% for refugees who arrived prior to July 2015, except for the particularly vulnerable. The United Nations says it requires roughly $500 million for its 2017 Uganda operations, but as of mid-March, had only received about $35 million, 7% of the total. Jill Craig, VOA News in northern Uganda.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with Leicester Nigerian forward Ahmed Musa, who is considering legal action after his agent Tony Harris described reports that he was arrested for beating up his wife on her birthday as inaccurate. The Nigerian international, who joined the Premier League champions last summer from CSKA Moscow for £16 million, was questioned by Leicester police in the early hours of Wednesday morning after they were called to a disturbance at his home. Ahmed Musa was later released without charge, and his agent has insisted reports of the 24-year-old's arrest hours after he had wished his wife Jamila happy birthday on Instagram had been exaggerated. And now to the latest FIFA ranking. Egypt are the best team in Africa after they moved up one spot from the 20th position in March to the 19th in the latest FIFA ranking released on Thursday. Senegal are second in Africa with 805 points. However, the Teranga Lions are 30th in the world. Cameroon are the third best team on the continent. The African champions, who the Super Eagles play in the World Cup qualifiers in August, dropped a place from 32 in March to 33. Burkina Faso are fourth on the continent. They moved up a place from 36 in March to 35. The Democratic Republic of Congo are sixth, while Tunisia dropped 5 places to be placed seventh, and Ghana are eighth after dropping 2 places in the latest ranking. Ivory Coast, who dropped a spot, and Morocco, who dropped 4 places, complete the African top 10. Brazil, who booked their place in the Russia 2018 World Cup with matches to spare, returned to the summit of the rankings after 7 years. The Samba Boys moved from second position in March to become the best football team in the world with 1,661 points. Argentina, who were previously on top, are now second, while Germany and Chile retained their third and fourth places. A host of former and active football stars are set to play an international exhibition match against human trafficking, insurgency and terrorism. No less than 46 African football legends have confirmed their participation in the Clash of Legends, a charity peace football match being organized by the Nwankwo Kanu Heart Foundation and the Nelson Mandela Foundation for Charitable Initiatives. The match will hold in Lagos at the Teslim Balogun Stadium. Among the many stars expected will be two-time former World Footballer of the Year and European Award winner George Oppong-Weah of Liberia and Abede Ayew-Pele of Ghana. Others expected include Patrick Mboma of Cameroon, Benny McCarthy from South Africa, Anthony Beaufort of Ghana, Kalusha Bwalya of Zambia, Lucas Radebe and Mark Fish of South Africa, among others. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, April 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte, wishing you a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Plans on Sunday? Now you do. I've prepared a totally enjoyable hour of amazing music from across the continent, just for you.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Banama ile nyugawa.
Special guests this week include Kenya's Gilad, Bubu Gang from Sierra Leone, and this year's Juno Award winners for Best World Music Album, Okavango African Orchestra. So, you see, you do have plans.
and I can't wait for you to join me this Sunday, 1500 and 2000 UTC on your VOA Africa FM station.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.